from St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.
Missourians this past election voted to enshrine legalized sports betting within the state's constitution. Its passage comes after several legislative sessions where efforts to legalize sports gambling failed in the Senate. And the main reason for said failure was a continued attempt to combine sports betting with the authorization of video lottery terminals, the video gaming machines often seen in gas stations. On this episode of Politically Speaking, Representative Bill Hardwick joins the show. Hardwick is the sponsor of legislation that would authorize VLTs in Missouri. Hardwick talks about his bill as well as his other impressions of the legislative session so far. Let's hit the music.
This is the Politically Speaking podcast, the definitive show about Missouri politics.
Let's go back to some of those policies, to that peace and prosperity that we had some 4 to 5 years ago.
Everywhere is Democratic country once this Democrat's been there.
There are a lot of things in Washington that are very bipartisan, including some bills that I've already gotten passed.
And I think it works best when you can see both sides, but you have to pick one, and I firmly align with the Republicans.
But certainly, I think if she's running against one of the crazy dudes, certainly it's going to be a lot easier.
But I'll take wisdom and age and a few missteps in oral to over somebody who has no substance.
I believe that you represent the party's values and you move forward, and that's what I have done.
Welcome to Politically Speaking. I'm your host, St. Louis Public Radio's Statehouse and Politics reporter, Sarah Kellogg. Joining me in St. Louis, he is St. Louis Public Radio's political correspondent,
Jason Rosenbaum.
And across from me in Jefferson City, he is the representative for the 121st District in the Missouri House,
Bill Hardwick.
Welcome back to the show. Always fun to have you on.
Yeah, thanks for having me back.
Lots to cover. Let's get right into it. And we're going to start with your bill that would create a regulatory framework for video lottery terminals, also known as VLTs. Can you tell us why you decided to take this thorny issue straight on?
Yeah, and it is a complex issue. I got into it because of business owners in my district, folks that owned restaurants, establishments, the VFWs, the truck stops. Who they were kind of like, you know, is this legal? Is this not legal? What can we do? You know, that sort of thing. So I started looking into the issue more and more and realized how complex it is. You've got no chance games throughout the state. There's also some completely unregulated games that fall into different categories around the state. And then you've got all these businesses throughout the state who've relied in COVID and the post-pandemic period on the cash flow from these games, right? That's part of their business model. So now we have this question, what do we do? What's legal? What's not legal? The no chance games definitely were innovative beyond what the statute calls for. Gambling in the statute is something for value put in, and there's a game of chance, or conditioned or contingent upon some future event, and there's value paid out. So there's a split among prosecutors and judges if that's illegal. And so I think that it's our job as legislature to say, here's clearly what's legal, what's not. I want to give businesses certainty, make it as minimally burdensome on the business owner as possible. And I also have an interest, especially given the economic uncertainty of future years in Missouri and nationally, of making sure we have a diversified way of raising revenue. And I think that's one way that we could raise revenue for schools and for other programs, right? More money for the state is beneficial for the services people rely on too. So that's my interest in it. I didn't realize how big and complex of an issue it would be, how there are many stakeholders with various industries who have a point of view about what that regulatory structure should look like. But I'm trying to be as fair as possible to everybody and just at the end of the day, do what I think is fair for the people of Missouri.
Your bill is very intricate. And rather than have you explain the entire thing, which could take way longer than the show allows, is it accurate to say that this would create a licensing system that would allow video lottery terminals to exist legally in places like fraternal organizations, gas stations,
right,
bars?
I think the bill will change. That's part of the process, especially to the House and Senate. I think that all different points of view are helpful in shaping into what the bill ought to be. But as it stands right now, all the gaming devices, the no chance games, the slot machines in Missouri, they would go away. And as an alternative, businesses can apply for a license to the lottery commission to have a lottery game, a video lottery game. And then they could split that fee structure with 34% going to the state, 33% to the operator, 33% to the retailer. And so that would just replace the existing structure. And then there'd be some regulation about you have to be 21 to play. Here's kind of the rules. You know, there's some gaming commission enforcement, but then it allows, you know, cash flow to continue for those establishments.
Where would the funds from this program go in the state?
Well, and it's a matter of discussion, too, about whether or not what structure is allowable under the Constitution. Article 39 says that after fees and cost, everything that goes into the lottery fund, all of it has to go to education. So money that's taken to that revenue that goes into the lottery fund, it all has to go to education, period. The Constitution is very clear about that. And the bill says as much. But we have an additional part where there's a fee that's assessed on the machines every year, $1,000 a year. And then that's broken down. A portion goes to the Highway Patrol for enforcement. A portion goes to the local municipalities for services. And then about 40% would go to the Veterans Commission, which would help them fund veterans' homes and stuff like that.
You aren't the first person to try to create a legal regulatory framework for VLTs. Now Secretary of State Denny Hoskins attempted to do this while he was in the Senate, and he received a lot of pushback, though I will say some of that pushback was because he tried to combine the issue of video lottery terminals and sports betting. But what are you hearing now about this issue?
I mean, I think there's still pushback from different industries. You know, you've got casinos in Missouri. You've got folks that are interested in their business model continuing as it is or being more favorable to them. And I think that's understandable. That's sensible. I think that Denny did well to say, hey, this is an issue that's important to me. Here's why I'm going to tackle it. I'm here to make sure that whatever product we can get to the legislature is what's the best product for the people of Missouri. And so any of those stakeholders, anybody who says, I oppose your bill because of whatever, well, I'll tell them, hey, come talk to me. Let's figure out why it's negative. It adversely affects your industry. And I'll try to work with you to try to create a regulatory framework that benefits the most people. And this is kind of like a John Rawls thing, not to reference John Rawls' theory of justice, but it's fair from everyone's point of view. I think that's important. It's actually something I agree with Rawls on, that you want a system that's fair from the person that's most disadvantaged by it. So that's what I'm kind of striving to accomplish.
You mentioned casinos. Are they opposed to creating a regulatory framework for video lottery terminals because they fear that it would create thousands of different entities that would be competition for them?
Well, speculating, because I don't want to speak for somebody else why they would oppose something. There, you know, the 13 licenses in Missouri. And so there's a limitation on gambling in Missouri, but there's also a monopoly. So I think the opposition is that would cut into the market share. But the reason why I don't think that's the reason why I question that opposition is because there are already gaming devices throughout the state of Missouri now, and revenues for casinos aren't in decline. So I think that there's a world in which, like in other states, where casinos can operate and there could be regulated gaming outside the casino, that both parties can thrive and succeed and prosper. I just want to make sure that there's some degree of regulatory parity, there's some sort of tax parity between those entities, and that, you know, they're fairly regulated. I don't think that we're going to make a truck stop have the exact same rules as a casino. But there are ways in which we can modulate the casino's regulation and modulate the truck stop regulation reasonably to have some type of parity there, I think.
I think the other element of opposition is from lawmakers or people who may be a bit queasy about expanding gambling, especially when it's addicting and it could lead to financial ruin. What have you heard on that front? And does your bill do anything to address problem gambling?
Yes. So not only have the last months before session started, have I tried to visit with stakeholders and businesses that are affected, from the coin operators to retailers, and be like, well, you know, what are your interests? I also kind of went around my district in the area, and I try to get feedback on this issue too. There are a lot of business owners, right? And they're concerned about continuity of cash flow. But a lot of people did bring up to me the fact that a big negative, and I'm very sensitive to this, of gambling in general and the lottery, is that it's a tax on working people, that there are people that have addictions to the vices and they're not being taken care of. So I told the folks in my district that any bill that we had would come out would have problem gaming funding and resources for that. And there would be ways in which we're trying to protect people from themselves. I think for me, there's a balance of paternalism versus freedom. And I talked before that I'm a big kind of make people make their own decisions kind of guy. I want less government in people's lives. But I'm also realistic in recognizing that if I create a regulatory structure that does this, there could be pitfalls where people's lives are destroyed by gaming addiction. So I want the final bill to definitely address that, to have problem gaming resources, to have some safeguards for people that are struggling with gaming addiction. And I think that anybody who's queasy about the bill now should also know that none of those things are in place in the entirely unregulated market that exists right now in Missouri. So that would be something, if we had a structure in place that had resources for problem gaming, that would be something new that doesn't exist now. And to your point, the point you just made about opposition, some of the opposition is they see kids playing, you know, they see kids playing games in truck stops and various places, right? and they're frustrated that there's no rules about it. And that's exactly what I'm trying to do, is find some rule structure that's reasonable, given the fact that I'm not eliminating gambling in the state of Missouri. I just want some reasonable structure, some, you know, way for the state to have an alternative method of raising revenue, and then just fair for businesses to be successful. If we do those things, clarity and regulation, Missouri businesses can thrive, and there's more revenue for schools, then those are kind of my general things that I want, that I would be satisfied with the product of the bill.
When your bill was heard in committee, there was some concern from lawmakers that basically municipalities wouldn't be able to impose their own bans or regulations. Kind of thoughts on that critique of saying, you know, if St. Louis said they didn't want this, they wouldn't be able to do anything about it.
Sure. And so one reason why I'm hesitant to have a provision like that altogether is because the lottery is a state regulated, it's a state game, it's a state program. So it seems strange to me the state can say we're selling these lottery tickets, for example, and then Springfield or St. Louis can say we don't want lottery tickets sold here. That seems odd to me. But at the end of the day, I'm ultimately willing to negotiate entirely on that if that's what members of the House and Senate feel is necessary for their districts to find this to be acceptable, if those counties and cities can opt out. I would like a period of time where the counties and cities could see what it would be like before they opt out, what it means in terms of revenue for their services, their local services, the counties and cities, and what it kind of means in terms of cash flow for their businesses. And I think, to me, that's what I prefer if we have an opt-out period. There's some period where they can kind of see how it goes first and then make a decision, an informed decision. But at the end of the day, on that provision, I am going to kind of listen to what the body thinks in both chambers. And if that is something, an opt-out provision is something that both the House and Senate feel is necessary to make it suitable for their districts, then I'm okay with it. But my personal preference is that it would just be a lottery. It'd be a lottery game, and there's not local opt-out personally. But I also recognize, this is part of my legislative philosophy, that everything I want is not what I get. There's 200 people here that got a vote, and that's why we're here, because we all have different points of view. So that's something I'm definitely willing to work with people on and get that language right, and, you know, amend it to have an opt-in provision that'll pass to the legislature that will be acceptable to the governor, too, at the end of the day.
I want to move on to a proposed ballot initiative that you have put forward that would make what I would feel is a pretty substantial change to what's known as the Missouri Nonpartisan Court Plan. Can you talk about what your proposed amendment would do?
Sure. My amendment makes a very small change to the Missouri Nonpartisan Court Plan, that if the commission sets three nominees to the panel to the governor, and the governor doesn't select any of those three nominees for the Supreme Court, for example, then instead of the commission picking out of the three who will be the Supreme Court judge, they would have to submit a new panel, and then the governor can pick. So it's just a small change that says the governor has the final say. My views on the Missouri plan have changed quite a bit, too, throughout my time as an attorney. So when I came to the legislature, I really thought that there was a branch of government that was sort of out of sight, out of mind of the people, that was left out of checks from the executive and legislative branch, and I thought that was a problem. So I filed a bill that was like the federal system, where the Senate confirms. And then I was in the legislature for 4 or 5 years now, and I realized the Senate cannot confirm judges in Missouri, because in the federal system, there was a standing filibuster, like in the Missouri Senate. And then over time, largely because of judicial nominees, that filibuster got eroded and eventually destroyed. And now there's functionally no filibuster in the United States Senate compared to the Missouri Senate. And that's because of the politicization of judicial nominees. And so if the Senate had to confirm judicial nominees in Missouri, I feel like the Democrats would have to filibuster any Republican nominee and vice versa. And the result would be this perpetual gridlock or an erosion of the filibuster, which I think would be bad too. The filibuster is important. So now and this is part of just being here in Jeff City and looking and learning and thinking, now I don't think that would be good for the state. So, okay, let's pinpoint the good and bad about the Missouri plan. The good is that we take Republican and Democrat out of it largely, or we try to. The good is that there's a system where there's a check with the people get to vote, to retain. There's a process by which, you know, lawyers can comply. There's a lot of positives to it. But if there's a critique that I think it's valid, it's that if the governor says none of these choices are acceptable, then the commission will just pick, and the governor could in some ways be left out of the process altogether. So I'd like to integrate the governor's ability to have some sort of final say, some sort of resolute say that he can't be gone around. And I think that would be one change that I'd make. And that's just kind of why – that's what my HGR reduced it down to. Not election of judges, not the federal system, not the Tennessee system, but just a small tweak to the Missouri system.
I know that Senate President Pro Tem Cindy O'Loughlin has been very critical of the Missouri plan. I'm looking at her SJR right now. I think that part of it involves like having like direct elections of judges in some respects. And what's interesting is when I look at other states, I see a lot of like election prognosticators being like, oh, we got to win the Supreme Court race in Wisconsin or North Carolina, so there's some sort of outcome, which I find very weird and distasteful, given that what we have in Missouri elections are kind of not really part of our system. Would you be hesitant to have elections directly of like Supreme Court or appeals judges for that reason?
I would be hesitant. There's part of it that's interesting to me to think about how you'd have people running for judge talking about their views on Donald Trump and wearing MAGA hats. But then you can also see like how we don't want our judiciary to be that. The Missouri plan itself, you know, there's a famous story about Tom Pendergrass and the political machinery, and the 1945 reform was a way to get away from political machinery. And even though I feel like nobody can really escape politics, there's always personal relationships, there's personal viewpoints everywhere. I think the idea of having a system of selecting judges that is away from the political machinery, the partisan machinery, the consultant machinery, the money in politics, that's probably a good thing. And it doesn't mean I don't think there's things we should do to kind of change a little bit and improve on it for what we want it to be. Definitely checks from an elected body like the governor, for example, an elected office. But I, you know, the more I've just come to realize, I think more and more about the idea that like having a judiciary where there's not an election, where there's not, you know, this money coming in and running ads and stuff like that might be a better thing for Missouri in the long run. We just don't want to get to the situation where that branch of government, insulated from that partisan process, becomes separated more and more from the will and the culture of the people of Missouri. So that's kind of a thought process I have there too. It's like when I go back and I run for re-election, I have to talk to people in my district and say, what's important to you? How do you feel about, you know, what's going on nationally? How do you feel about state level stuff? How do you feel about social issues? And listen to them. And I have to be responsive to them to win my election. So the judiciary is good to be separate from that money process, but the pitfall is that there's a bigger and bigger divergence from the culture of Missouri, I think. So that's kind of, we want to have ways to make sure we bridge that gap, but we also don't want to make it so that they're running like they're a legislator or a statewide office holder. Because the judiciary is something fundamentally different than those other branches of government. So what I'm just saying is I think there's a lot of good to having this non-elected, non-partisan process. It doesn't mean it can't be improved in some ways, but there's a lot of value to that I'm thinking more and more as I kind of mature as a legislator, honestly, as I kind of mature as a hopefully into a statesman.
We need to take a quick break, but we'll be right back. And we're back on Politically Speaking. Our guest today is Representative Bill Hardwick. He is the representative for the 121st District in the Missouri House. Let's go into Missouri's newest governor, Mike Kehoe, and his agenda. What do you think about his push to have a gubernatorial board oversee the St. Louis Police Department?
I think that he committed to addressing crime in St. Louis, and I think that he's sincere in what he said he would do. And I think, and you know, not speaking for the governor or maybe the legislature, just my observation is that a lot of people feel like St. Louis police control is a way in which we can make St. Louis police officers grow their recruitment force, grow their ability to enforce criminal laws in the St. Louis area, and that's important. And I think that, you know, around the state economically, people go on to Cardinals games, people who are, you know, adjacent to the St. Louis area, crimes is still a concern. And so his commitment is to say the streets of St. Louis are going to be safe. And here are things that we can do that are definitely going to institute a change and that we'll think will address the safety issue in St. Louis. So I think that that's in good faith. I think that that's one of the things that's going to be touchy. It's a touchy issue in the legislature because you have members from the St. Louis area who don't want the state coming in and dominating the process for their local area. So that's a debate. But I think that the motive and the plan is a plan that's good, and it's a plan that's necessary because we need to do something to address crime.
Do you think having this oversight will make St. Louis safer? And if so, why?
What I think it'll do is it will. So it's kind of interesting. I think what it'll do is it'll say, you know, St. Louis is this economic hub, this economic engine of the state. There's a statewide interest in being able to travel the state of St. Louis and employers come to St. Louis and be safe. And so we're able, and what's been going on in St. Louis hasn't been working. I think it's the issue that there's to be a change. And we've gone back and forth even from the Civil War to the 2012 vote, I think, about St. Louis local control, police control. And there are a lot of smart people who have different viewpoints on it. But I think for me, it looks like it's not working because there's still a lot of violent crime in St. Louis. And there's been a lot of major strides forward with the change of the circuit attorney. There's been a lot of movements forward that I think have been positive for St. Louis. But I think that if you run a campaign where you say, I'm going to address crime, and this is one of the things I'm going to do to address crime, is to say the oversight of St. Louis Police Department right now is not working. The state's going to intervene, and we're going to be able to make changes that we think are going to make people safer, right? From the state, we're making those changes, and the people elect you partly on that. Then you have a mandate to see it through. And I think it's what the governor's doing, and I think that's kind of the push that's happening in the legislature. Those bills are moving quickly through the House, the St. Louis Police Control bills. It's contentious debate. We should be thoughtful about what members and legislators from St. Louis are saying that their constituents want and don't want. That's part of our process, too. But we need to address violent crime in St. Louis, and I think that's part of the way we can do that.
I'm not trying to deny that there's like crime problems in St. Louis and Kansas City, because they clearly are. But I feel like this discussion that always centers on the urban areas kind of gives this connotation that there's no crime in rural counties, which is not true. So like, what do you want the governor to do to try to help bring down crime maybe in your district or nearby districts?
I think that's a really fair response, though, for one, that there's a lot of crime in rural Missouri, too. And that's true. When I was a prosecutor, it seemed like the crime was associated with drug addiction. It was meth addiction when I first became a prosecutor, and then it became heroin addiction and then opiate addiction. That a lot of the burglaries and stealing cases occurred with somebody who struggled with that addiction or who got caught in that trap of drug addiction. And that occurs a lot in rural Missouri. And so I think it's a really good point that we always say, hey, there's crime in St. Louis, but there, you know, there's the catalytic converter stealing epidemic in rural Missouri. There's still violent crime in rural Missouri. And I was a prosecutor. There were still murderers. There were still armed robberies. I think there's a whole gamut of things that we can do as a state, right, in addressing drug addiction and addressing the fentanyl problem, which the governor addressed in the state of the state. And, you know, there are a lot of people in my district who wanted that to be part of his priority. I think that's a big part of it. There's a whole numerous amount of things in terms of treatment courts, in terms of rehab, in terms of even more police officers and better resourced police officers in rural Missouri. There are a lot of sheriff's departments and local police departments who they can't pay their officers enough. They don't have resources to train their officers. And so if we have a comprehensive approach to crime, we've got to make it easier for someone to be a police officer and provide for their family all over the state. And we got to make sure that the sheriff's departments and those police departments are resourced. I think that's important. That's a really good point that you make. And I think that that's a pitfall that even I fall into. We go, hey, crime in St. Louis, crime in Kansas City. But there are people who are victims of crime throughout the entire state. And we really should have a statewide comprehensive approach to it.
The other big takeaway from Kehoe's State of the State speech, from my perspective, is that Missouri's budgetary situation is just not going to be as good as it was compared to like the final couple years of the Parson administration. How do you think that will affect the rest of the session?
So first of all, it's going to be a paradigm shift for the members of the House and the members of the Senate, but particularly members of the House, who my last 4 years, we have had lots of federal supplementation of our budget, CARES Act money, American Rescue Plan money, infrastructure money. And we're used to being able to say, hey, we've got a project, we've got an idea for our district, maybe it's in terms of treatment or crime, and we have a way to fund it. But that outlook is not going to be the same, especially given you've even seen what the Trump administration has done in its first few weeks. So that huge budget supplementation is not something we should be used to. So I think we got to shift our paradigm on the budget. We have to know that we have to make some cuts, and we have to think about programs that are sustainable, that we can continue to maintain them in terms of what the cost that they incur. And then we have to think about more ways to make sure we kind of restructure our revenue structure in Missouri so we can withstand what could be a big economic contraction the next couple of years, what could be shortfalls of revenues, what could be a pretty uncertain national and global economic climate. Yeah. So I think that we just have to think about it differently. And we're so used to that saying, hey, whatever we want, we can get this $1 million here, $10 million here. Well, those days are gone. And the responsible statesman is going to have to make hard choices about things to cut and what to prioritize. So if I would prioritize public safety, public education, infrastructure, and then kind of our economic development programs, right? Those make the most sense to me. And then everything else, it's going to be a political fight about whether or not your program should be prioritized, be part of the budget too.
So speaking on education, you know, something that might prompt some controversy is Kehoe's proposal to send $50 million in state funds to educational savings accounts. Given that this was marketed as a tax credit program, do you think direct funding of scholarships that could go to private schools may be a bridge too far for some Republicans?
I don't know. I think that just like on any issue, Republicans change the way they think about stuff. The ESA program was passed in 2021, you know, barely, right? 82 votes. I voted for that. And then there have been different versions that increase the program, enhance the program with different other things involved in it, right? And those coalitions are different depending on how you package it. So I think that a coalition for an issue is not a stagnant thing. It's dynamic depending on what's part of the deal. Maybe direct funding for private schools and Christian schools and charter schools is part of a package, but we can see what else is on the table to know whether or not you can get to 82 folks in the House and then the 18 people in the Senate. So it's hard to say, you know, if you have an issue in itself, people may have a certain viewpoint on it now, but after they think about it and if they understand it different ways, their viewpoints will change. And if you have that issue in conjunction with other issues, people's viewpoints on it change as well. So it's just hard to say to have an issue kind of like in a vacuum. That's not the way we deal with issues or coalitions develop. Issues develop in concert with several other issues. So yeah, for sure. I think that's definitely on the table in the House. It just kind of depends what the whole deal of the legislative package is.
So have you found that your constituents have taken advantage of ESAs, given that I would assume there's not a ton of private schools in Pulaski County?
I don't think anyone in my district or nearby is eligible for the ESA program as it exists. So I don't know after 727 passed, I've not heard of anybody who's taking advantage of it in the district. But prior to that, there was nobody who was eligible for it. There were some people who said, hey, we'd love to see that here. And there's people who said we would not like to see that here, right? It's like anything else, I just got to think it through about what's fair for everybody.
Regarding education funding, despite the historic investment that Keough is asking for public schools, it technically is falling short of what the Department of Elementary and Secondary Education is asking for. What do you make of that? And also, do you think that this is a consequence of the giant education bill passed last year? And is that something that maybe needs to be reevaluated if that causes a level of funding that might be unattainable in future sessions?
Sure.
Or even this one?
I think that the governor is doing the responsible thing. That we talked about, our budget outlook is not as certain and not as flush as it was the last couple of years. So you've got to think about, okay, what's really important? You know, what needs to be cut? How are we going to sustain it? How are we going to make sure there's money for future years and future education years? I think that the question of allocating funds and appropriating funds is a political question. That's why you have a legislative body. That's why you have a governor in the process. So DESE or whomever can say, here's what we recommend for a target. But I think it's better government to have the elected officials who are elected to appropriate make those decisions, right? Because we're accountable directly to our districts that have different interests and different viewpoints throughout the state. But we come together from 163 districts in the House and 34 districts in the Senate to make those decisions. So I think we're better suited to make those decisions than DESE or an elected body. And the governor coming in, he has a better picture about what's the budget going to look like, you know, for the next 4 years of his term too, what he's concerned about. So I think he's doing the responsible thing by saying, look, you've asked for this, but I can't give you what I asked for. I'm going to fund education more, and we're going to make sure we have a long-term proposition for public education in Missouri.
Okay, but then if some of that, you know, 727, which was the education bill, had a very hefty price tag on it, do you think it was irresponsible for the legislature to pass that if this is the result of the funding that you might not be able to make?
Well, not to rehash an old wound, but I voted no on 727. Partly was the fiscal no. I mean, there was a couple reasons. There's some other reasons in the bill that kind of had hesitancy on. And it wasn't just a general ESA structure, but part of it was a fiscal no that I was worried about whether or not we could fund, and we put ourselves on the hook for something that just kept growing and growing and growing without a plan. I mean, part of the VLT plan is a way to increase money for education, right? That's part of what I'm trying to work on. But I think that was a concern that a lot of fiscal conservatives had, that there's a huge price tag and there's a variable upwards. And I think that we have the bill now. I think that there's a lot of ways to go forward with supporting public education and supporting school choice and education reform. But I think the way that he approached it was exactly the right way, which is and I have tons of respect for Dr. Esslinger, former Senator Esslinger and DESE. She's awesome. But I think that's the right thing to say. They can recommend something, but the legislature and the governor have to decide, given all the other viewpoints they have, what the best way to go about funding is, given the resources we have. And there's a huge discussion, even in tax reform, about, okay, are we going to have resources going forward in the future? Are we whatever? And I'll make one more point about that. I've always thought it was a misnomer to associate increased revenues with increased ability to spend in the future, because a natural consequence of inflation is you'll have more money coming in, but those dollars won't go as far. because everything else is more expensive, right? The dollar's devalued. So we saw our revenues go up and we thought we had plenty of money to spend, but the cost of everything, even for the state, went up at the same time. So we just got to be more prudent about that. And, you know, we're funding ESAs, we're funding public education. It just may not be a model that somebody outside the legislature comes up with. But that's part of why we have this fight. We fuss, cuss, and discuss here in the chamber.
Kehoe mentioned his desire to eventually eliminate the state income tax, but not all at once. How realistic do you think this is without substantially increasing sales taxes or property taxes?
It's probably not realistic without making a makeup and revenue somewhere else, whether that is sales tax or consumption tax or property tax or just other things that we tax, right? Because just like we were talking about people reliant on cash flow, there are local ambulance districts, there are local municipalities, there are there's social services funding that relies on income tax now. Conceptually, I kind of like the idea of not having income tax because I think it helps people save money, invest money, and pass on wealth to their children. And that's probably a good thing if we're incentivized to invest and save and grow family household wealth. I think that could be a good thing. But I do think that if we get rid of the income tax, we have to think about, okay, that means there's a sales tax decrease somewhere. If somebody like a state like Texas has a bigger property tax. There are several states that don't have an income tax, but Missouri would be the first state to get rid of its income tax and figure out how to make up all that revenue somewhere. And that's a process. But, you know, I applaud the governor who's saying, hey, this is something that's good for the state. Let's go forward with it. This will make us a more prosperous state, not just in terms of economics and commerce, but maybe at the household level, right? People can save more. They get a bit more money in CDs and the bank account. That's probably a good thing. But there is a discussion. There's a flurry of activity throughout the building about, okay, that money's gone. Where do you make it up? And are you penalizing the city of St. Robert? Are you penalizing the city of Rolla, right? So that's just a discussion we have to have. And the best way to have the discussion is to listen to local fire departments, the local school districts, the city of Rolla, whomever, and say, okay, what works, what doesn't work for you, what's going to make your life harder, what's going to make your life easier, and just be open to making changes based on the feedback we have from people who rely on that money.
Something that Kehoe didn't talk about fully was any plan to repeal or replace Amendment 3. Do you think that that might be a bigger topic of discussion during the 2026 session than the 25, given that that will be an election year?
I think that it's a big topic of discussion right now because, you know, when Amendment 3, a lot of us went out and we campaigned against it and we raised, and I did town halls on it and we had debates on it. We talked about why we're opposed to it. And a lot of conservatives said, we'll continue to be opposed to it even if it passes or we'll fight against it. And that's a commitment. And it's just, it's also a conviction that people have to protect life. And so in the House and Senate, talked to a lot of senators, a lot of House members who they really want to see something done to address Amendment 3 immediately and also have the time to have another year if it's on the ballot in 2026 to be able to campaign, to be able to put a campaign together and go out and work the state basically for it. So I think that because abortion is such a critical, I mean, it's a critical issue for both parties. Both parties' bases are very, very engaged in what happens with that issue. But because it's such a critical issue of the Republican Party, the coalition, a lot of people would say it's the top issue in the Republican Party. And I think that's true. If you talk to a lot of Republican voters, you know, they will not vote for somebody who is pro-abortion. They will not. And that's part of the Republican Party and the conservatism we had made up for today. So that it exists today. So I think that we need to address it as quickly as possible. And I think that Amendment 3 is too far to the extreme and that it was close and that there are a lot of members who are making the case right now to leadership in both chambers, to the governor and to any group that will listen to them, that we should address Amendment 3. And I think that if the Senate gets to a point where they say, okay, what's going to be the showdown? What's going to be the erosion of our filibuster power this year? It would be over the issue of life and abortion because I think that a lot of times if you're not in rural Missouri, you're not in the churches in our communities, you're not in the kitchen table, I think in Jeff City we underestimate how big of an issue that is for a lot of people to defend life and protect life. And so the people who got elected on that issue, who promised to deal with that issue, they're pretty determined to address it.
Speaker Patterson mentioned that Representative Melanie Stinnett's proposed ballot measure may be the vehicle that goes through the House, and it would not allow for anyone to get an abortion except for medical emergencies, fetal anomalies, rape, or incest. And so, you know, Amendment 3 did pass Missouri, and Missouri is a state that overwhelmingly elected Republicans on a statewide measure. I know the House and Senate stayed the same, but on a statewide, you know, elected Republicans, which means there are Republicans who voted for Amendment 3. And I think it is too simple to say that they didn't understand what they were voting for. There's a scale there, and Republicans aren't a monolith on this issue, I think. And so do you think that any anti-Amendment 3 plan would need to allow a provision, you know, allowing someone to get an abortion for any reason between 8 to 12 weeks in order to pass muster with voters?
Yeah, I agree that Republican voters are not a monolith, even on the issue of abortion, and neither are Republican candidates. They offer a lot. I mean, abortion is an important issue. Life is an important issue. But there's lots of things Republicans campaign on, too. I think that, you know, we've talked this so much that polling data seems to indicate that most people want some restrictions on abortion, but greater than 50% of people think there should be exceptions for health of the mother, medical exceptions, rape and incest. That seems to be where polling data is. I would support something that made Missouri a more pro-life state. And if an amendment with those exceptions is what we can do, then I'll support it. But I think that there is definitely a divide in what that should look like in terms of what Missouri is in terms of pro-life state and banning abortion and regulating abortion. But I would support that because I think it's a lot better than what we have now with Amendment 3. It's an improvement. I think that even those things are kind of tricky, and that's what we've talked through. We talked through in Amendment 3. We heard feedback when people said, hey, we're for Amendment 3. We're against the heartbeat bill because we think the medical exception is not quite right. It puts too much of a burden on doctors because there is nothing that, you know, if there's a young person who's a victim of sexual assault or rape, like it doesn't address that clearly. I've heard that kind of feedback on the campaign trail this last year. My viewpoint is that, you know, when you become a human being, that you should have human rights attributed to you, that you become a person a lot longer before you're born, and that we should protect that human life. That's really important. But I've never approached it with the attitude that I have condemnation or I want to punish or hurt people who have different viewpoints or, you know, in that situation. I just want to make sure that we protect human life and that we, you know, protect those young lives, those innocent lives, and those vulnerable lives as much as we can in the state.
Getting Republican lawmakers to agree on something regarding a response to Amendment 3 is different than getting a majority of votes to agree. Sure. So I'm going to ask it again. Do you think that having a window of like 8 to 12 weeks would be required to get Missouri voters to vote for it to that degree? Because ultimately, you have to wonder, it's all a big game of what ifs, but you have to wonder if Amendment 3 would have passed if there was a weak ban like that in the first place, and it wasn't just a completely, you know, very limited scope. Mm-hmm. So I guess kind of thoughts on that.
I think that there are a lot of people who may even liked Amendment 3, but would still vote for the new version with those exceptions. I think it kind of depends on how you go to people and how you persuade people. I think there are a lot of people who actually change their mind about issues a lot too. And it depends on how the case is made. And I think in initiatives or referendum, the way the ballot measure is worded is very, very critical. If it's clear, if it makes sense, if people are suspicious of it, if it has phrases that sort of resonate with people, I think it's very critical too. So I think it depends on those things. It depends on the campaign. It depends on how it's resourced. It depends on how much do reps go, and they go to the churches and they go to the synagogues and they go to the town halls and they say, here's why I support this or not. And it also depends on how it's worded. If people read it and they go, hey, that makes sense. I think the wording of ballot measures makes a huge difference in Missouri. You have so many tens of thousands of people, maybe, you know, I don't know how many, but lots of people who've never seen an ad, who've never talked to their state rep, and they go in and all they know about that measure is how it's worded. So I think it being clear and concise and intuitive is very important as well.
Well, I want to shift topics one more time before we let you go. There's been a lot of attention in the Missouri Senate over a bill that would, I guess, incentivize bounty hunters to find people in Missouri without legal status. I read through Senator Gregory's bill. I believe it would put somebody in prison for life without the possibility of parole unless the governor intervenes if they are in Missouri without legal status. I think that Speaker Patterson is not very fond of this idea. I'm interested in your take on this high profile proposal.
Yeah, for sure. And I'll give the initial thoughts about how we do want a secure border. We want to be strict on immigration. That's important. But in our efforts to do that, we probably don't want to give the government power and also create an incentive structure that could be used for all kinds of things that are bad. I was against where they said, hey, if your neighbor's not wearing a mask or leaving their home during the lockdown, you turn them into the government. So those schemes where we say, hey, we want to incentivize people to kind of tell on their neighbors to the government, I think those are generally pretty bad. And again, how does the person who's trying to get the bounty know that someone is in the United States illegally? How can they tell by looking at them or talking to them? That seems like we're breaking down trust between people in our state and our country, where what we want to be to have a successful society is build more trust. So again, I think strict immigration enforcement, I think close the border. I think the human trafficking and fentanyl that's coming across the border, those are all very serious issues that we should be strong on to address. But I don't think that bill is a good way to do it. I'm a due process guy. I'm a limited government guy. And then the issue of life without parole, right now in Missouri, you get that for first degree murder. And there's a reason why that's the strictest penalty we have besides the death penalty in Missouri is life without parole. And it probably should be reserved for things like first degree murder, not being in the country illegally.
Yeah, so, and just to interject, like, you're a former prosecutor, and I this is going to be an extreme example, but if you purposely take a hammer and hit a child with it and they don't die, they wouldn't go to jail for life in prison without parole, correct?
They would not be eligible for a sentence of life without parole. That's correct. I think the points that maybe both of us converge to are why we have criminal penalties at all, which are deterrence or retribution proportionality. So you have sentences that are based on proportion to the crime, the harm the person did, right? Which in your case, you know, harming an infant, harming a child, kind of as I talked earlier, I think is pretty heinous, pretty horrible. There should be stricter penalties for that. And then for murder, for assault, those sort of things, or deterrence, right? We're trying to deter people from doing certain things. And, you know, and again, I supported President Trump. I support closing down the border. I support strict immigration enforcement. But we also, you know, I talk to conservatives and they say there are a lot of people in Central America, around the world, in South America, in Europe, who they don't blame people for trying to get into America, who have a better life, who are in a hard situation around the world. And so I think that while we want to be strict on border enforcement, we also want to make sure that, you know, there's a lot of books you read, you know, on Trinquier and stuff like that. And there's always this thing, this phenomenon about in your effort to address a serious problem, you like become the monster, become the thing you're trying to stop. And so we should address these serious problems, but we should also remember that there's a constitution in America. There are limitations on police and government power for good reason. And there are restraints on the passions of the people that are found in the Republican form of government that we should respect given any crisis or situation.
That is all the time we have. Thank you so much, Representative Hardwick, for joining us on the show. Politically Speaking is a part of St. Louis Public Radio, which is owned by the University of Missouri, St. Louis. You can find all of our work by going to stlpr.org. And Representative, where can people find you on the internet where you want to be found?
Yeah, if you Google me, just ignore all those news articles. Those aren't factual. Just kind of, I don't know, Facebook. I don't know. I'm very bad at this answer. I'm here at the Capitol. Come find me at the Capitol. Okay, cool.
Thank you so much. And until next time, bye.
Politically Speaking is produced by Sarah Kellogg, Rachel Lipman, and me, Jason Rosenbaum. The show is edited by Fred Ehrlich. Read all of our coverage at stlpr.org. And if you haven't already, make sure to subscribe to Politically Speaking by searching the term Politically Speaking on Apple Podcasts. From St. Louis Public Radio. This is Politically Speaking.